Each month we speak with John Rafferty, the Chief Executive of the CNIB in Toronto, Canada's largest sight loss charity, providing a whole range of services, and he joins us once again. John, how's the weather in Canada?
Cooking hot, a little bit humid, but absolutely wonderful. We have nothing to shovel this month.
No snow whatsoever.
No snow whatsoever.
Always a good day. Now, we've got a couple of topics we're going to be chatting about today, John. And we shall start with an update on a topic we've looked at, I suppose it was in the early days, of a guide dog service.
We're entering kind of the final phase of completing the business cycle of a guide dog. So you're a dog user yourself, I believe, Alan.
Yep.
So you're kind of familiar with the steps. But guide dogs kind of go through a number of different phases. And we're about to place our first dogs into teams with individuals. So we have dogs in guide dog training right now, and as well as puppies in locations across the country that are with puppy raisers and getting ready for that next stage of training. So it takes a couple of years from when you start to placing the first dog as a working team. And we're very excited to be doing that really in the coming weeks.
It is a huge undertaking, John, to start, if you like, from scratch at a guide dog school, because you know you have to get the staff in place, the training regime in place. The puppies don't come off a production line. They have to be trained. You know, not all may make it straight away either. So patience is really needed for something like this on both fronts, because I'm sure that there are many people in Canada who are looking forward to being able to apply to another organisation which can provide such a vital service.
Yeah, I think that we're looking to add an additional service, not replace any of the ones that are here. The majority of Canadians have always gone to the US, and we've always been very thankful to the US guide dog schools. But there are people who would prefer to get a dog in Canada, and we're looking forward to being able to fill a bit of the gap in the quantity of dogs that are available. But it is it's an interesting process. One of the things that we have to pay attention to is, as soon as we place a dog with someone now, we need to be prepared to provide a replacement dog for that individual in 7 years' time on average. So you have this very long view of the need of an individual. You know, if someone gets their first dog in their 30s, they're going to have 7-8 dogs probably in their working life. So we have to think, you know, from a business plan perspective, what are we doing 7 years, 14 years, 21 years from now to serve that individual?
Do you have an idea of what the interest is like? Do you know roughly perhaps what your applications will be to have a guide dog?
In the early stages, the volume of puppies and therefore the volume of graduating dogs is going to be fairly minimal, as we're really focused on making sure we've got the quality in embedded in the program that we need before we start increasing the volume of dogs. So we're not doing a lot at the moment to try and kind of beat the bushes for applicants at all, because we're expecting to place 6 or 7 working teams this fall, probably 10 to 15 next year, and then we'll start increasing volume. So we believe that the difference in the number of guide dog users in Canada versus the UK, as an example, is about 700 or 800 proportionally. Less guide dog users in Canada is what our research says. So we think that there's a need for us to be placing 60, 70 or more dogs per year over time. We've got a number of good schools in Canada, but they are smaller schools that have produced a fairly limited number of dogs relative to the population of Canada. I think the French population in Canada has been well served from a supply standpoint from the school out of Montreal, but Canada is also a really big piece of geography, and it's difficult to satisfy the needs everywhere, which is why the majority of people, certainly in English Canada, have gone to the US. And I do think that barrier for a lot of people of thinking, do I have to go to America? And to be honest, for some people, the barrier of thinking, do I have to go to Ottawa or Toronto or Vancouver, where other schools are located, if they live in Winnipeg or Saskatchewan, is a challenge as well. So we will see how much of that demand we fill over time.
What about partnerships themselves? So when someone is matched with a dog and they go through the training and they graduate, is there help after that with the costs of keeping a dog?
Yeah, so we've got ongoing help. We'll be paying for the food and the veterinary support for the dog through the working life of the dog. The program comes at no cost to the end user. For those who are end users who, you know, benefit from that, you know, we will be happy if they want to make donations back to help others come into the program. But from a user standpoint, we don't want to have any financial barriers.
What about within Canada itself, then, the kind of the wider area? How receptive are they to having guide dogs? I'm thinking, you know, access, you know, travel, maybe restaurants, cinemas, that kind of thing.
So we've got an amazing individual that joined the team about a year ago now to head up engagement and advocacy side of the work. And she's been doing a lot of work. She's a past Paralympian, guide dog user herself, working in communities across the country, helping provide support to existing dog users about their rights, doing a lot of proactive advocacy work. We met recently with the association in Canada called Restaurants Canada, the Association of Restaurants. I think they have something like 45,000 members, talking about access, because, you know, to your point, having a great team, having a great dog with an individual is obviously paramount. But if the communities in which you travel, people aren't aware, we still have instances, unfortunately, on a regular basis of people being denied access, but also the way that communities are being designed and built, are they accommodating to the ability for an individual to travel safely with a guide dog? So there's a huge advocacy part to our program. That is as much a factor in the success of a good working team as the quality of the dog and the training of the individual themselves.
It's great how we often talk, John, about technology empowering blind, visually impaired people and helping with independence. But, you know, still we need our four-legged friends as well.
Yeah, no, we do. And we're looking at, you know, how we help train alongside the use of the partnership with the dog, how we train individuals on the technology they can use alongside the dog. So we've been joking that all of our dogs are coming with an iPhone. We're not actually providing the iPhone to the dog, but we want individuals to be using the technology that goes along with the dog itself. So it's not a one solution. People have to use everything that's available to them.
We'll continue to get the latest on the guide dog school then, John. Some great news though so far, and it sounds like things are running really well. But we're going to finish off with one more topic on entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so we've been working for the last 6 months, mostly really in the learning stages of how do we create entrepreneurship and what are the tools we need to provide as a backstop to individuals so that the gig-based economy, self-employment, small business ownership, those are viable options for individuals who are blind or partially sighted in terms of participating in the workforce. You know, we all know the trends generally away from the, you know, the one employer, 9-to-5 job for someone's life into, you know, more gig-based work. And so we've been holding open houses across the country. We've got a great individual who is an entrepreneur, a member of the community himself. He's been talking to individuals that have desires to move in that area. And we're launching programs that will help people with everything from understanding social media marketing, how to build a website, how to set up your basics around accounting and bookkeeping, how to build a business plan, et cetera. So what are the tools that we need to provide for individuals, and how do we connect them into these entrepreneurship groups so they can feed off each other? And we're hoping as we go through this that we're going to start seeing some really good success stories around entrepreneurship within the blind and partially sighted community. And we can share kind of the journey of how people are successful with others in order to inspire and support others.
Do you think that some visually impaired people look at starting their own business because they're almost perhaps forced to, you know, difficulties getting into the kind of mainstream labour market?
I'm not going to say it's unique to Canada. I think that one of the increasing issues in Canada, maybe larger than in many European countries, is the sheer geography and lack of transportation. So we all know that one of the biggest barriers to work and participation in the more traditional labor market is the ability to get to and from a workplace. And if you're in a large urban center, or Toronto or Ottawa or Vancouver, where there are, you know, public transit links, that's fine. But in many smaller towns and rural communities, there just is no rail link, there's no bus link, there's no way of getting to and from. So I think that there's a combination of things. Yes, I think that there are still these barriers, and we need to address those barriers with mainstream employers. And we're doing a number of things on that front. Maybe in a future show, we'll talk about kind of some of the things around traditional employment.
And having peer support, if you like, and hearing from people who've been there, ironed out a lot of the issues, is a big bonus.
Absolutely. You know, having individuals who have had success, and I think success has a very different form for different people. You know, some people want something that's driven around a hobby that's going to provide some additional income into a household. In others, it's about starting a business and making a ton of money. So having people that have done the varying degrees of gig and entrepreneur work to have as a network to talk to, I think will be incredibly useful.
Is there general government support then for people who are looking to start their own business, whether that's advice or financial, then that CNIB will complement?
There are general programs, and the government is grappling with these issues around employment in rural and remote areas, and how to connect people. So we are very aligned with a lot of the government programs in this area. But most of those programs are quite generic across all individuals, and they don't necessarily serve our community quite as well as I think the government want them to. So we're looking at understanding how can we play an augmenting or an additional role to the types of programs governments are running to make them more accessible, more inclusive, and more effective for individuals who are blind or partially sighted.
John, we're almost out of time once again. It does fly, actually. If people would like to learn more about CNIB, the services, and, perhaps more on guide dogs and entrepreneurship, what's the best way to do that?
There's always lots of content on our website at cnib.ca. You can follow us on Twitter or become a friend of ours on Facebook.
John, pleasure as always. We'll catch up with you again next month, but thank you for speaking with us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope everyone has a great rest of the summer.